This is the State of Things from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. Thank you. Robert Brown is a man of remarkable achievements. Back in the mid-1950s, he became one of the first African-American officers with the High Point Police Department. He distinguished himself in that job so much that he was recruited as a federal narcotics agent, which brought him to the attention of a young lawyer named Robert Kennedy. Then in 1960, he started a public relations firm that was employed by big corporations like Woolworths and A&P, and a social activist, Martin Luther King Jr. And he eventually landed a job at the White House during the Nixon administration. Robert Brown is a businessman and a bridge between opposing sides in a struggle for social change and racial justice. He's the founder and CEO of BNC International. It's one of the oldest minority-owned consulting firms in the nation. He still lives and works in High Point, North Carolina, and he joins me again on The State of Things. Robert Brown, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
We tried to pack your career into 1 hour, and even The State of Things couldn't do that, so I'm very happy that you're back. We left you in the mid-1960s. We talked about the fact that you were among the first African-American police officers in the High Point Police Department in 1956. That brought you to the attention of the Treasury Department and other federal agencies, and you became a federal drug agent, moved to New York. And we talked a little bit about some of your career there. But what you were doing was bringing successful cases, right, bringing the evidence to successfully bring down some important drug dealers in the nation through New York City. That brought you to the attention of Robert Kennedy. Tell us how you met.
Well, we met because Robert Kennedy was the chief counsel for the Senate Racket Committee under Senator John McClellan in Washington. And they were working on the mafia. They were trying to figure out how they could penetrate the mafia. And Senator sent him to New York to see how cases were being made against the mafia. And since I was one of the principal agents in the bureau who was working on the mafia during that time, he wanted to talk to me, and he wanted to see how a case was being made. So he spent the evening following me around along with a number of his assistants and everybody else. They were off in the distance. They wanted to see what I was doing. And that's how I got to know him. After we spent the evening together, he gave me his telephone numbers and everything, asked me to call him if I needed anything, if I'm in Washington and so forth. And then later on, he decided to, of course, run for the Senate. Well, first of all, his brother ran for president. And when his brother ran for president, I had just resigned from the bureau in New York, and they asked me, the senator had worked something out with the people in New York that I would become director of information and research for the Young Democrats in New York City, which I did, and worked for Jack Kennedy's campaign, and he was elected, and then I went on about my business trying to establish
it. We don't just get director of information for the Democratic Party, and he was elected. Here was a guy who was not going to win. He's the first Catholic. There was a real close race.
Right.
What was your job? What were you doing for Kennedy and the Democrats?
I was doing a little bit of everything. I was designated as that person who would go take one of the campaign limos and go to the airport and pick up important people. And I'd say, who were coming in to support the senator, and I would say one of the most important, if not the most important person that I picked up was Harry Truman. They told me President Truman was coming in, and he needed to be massaged and everything, so they sent me to the airport to pick him up. So I picked up President Truman, and when I said who I was and everything and showed up at the airport, shook his hand and told him I had the limo waiting and so forth, he seemed a little bit startled and surprised. But after we got in the car, we started to talk, and we talked all the way into town. I mean, through all of the traffic from the airport into Manhattan. And he was a very interesting man. And later in the evening, I saw him again, and he wanted to talk some more. So I had experiences with some extraordinary people.
Had you started your PR firm by then?
I was just getting ready to do that. In fact, after the campaign was over, I came back. I moved back to North Carolina and started my PR firm. And everybody told me I was crazy because they said in New York, that even my district supervisor, the bureau, he said, hey, you got a great job here. You're making more cases than anybody in the bureau. He said, you're going to be a top agent. You're going to be one of our top agents, and you're going to have supervisory positions and everything else. He said, if you go back to North Carolina, nothing's going to happen to you because everything is segregated back there. He said, even if you got some clients, say you can't even take them in a restaurant because everything is segregated and you can't go in a restaurant to eat. And I said to him, I said to Mr. Gaffney, his name was George Gaffney, I said, Mr. Gaffney, I said, I'm not going back to North Carolina to be a part of the problem. I'm going back to North Carolina to see what I can do to help my state and my people, all of my people. I said, I feel that way, and that's what I'm going back to North Carolina for. And I said, whatever comes out of it, comes out of it. But I feel passionate about this, and I'm going to do that. He said, well, you have a great job here. Mm. You can retire in 20 years, and you're one of the top agents now in the bureau, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, hey.
Well, the picture he's painting, of course, is that things were better in the North at that time, and the Kennedy seemed to be a progressive force for change. But there's a lot of question about where John Kennedy was on the question of race, and to what extent it was just, you know, politics as usual, and how much he was following and how much he was leading. What was your sense of where John Kennedy was on the question of race?
Well, he seemed, I didn't have that much contact with him. I mean, I would see him when he would come into town, and he would come through and shake all of the campaign people's hands and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I didn't sit down and have a conversation with him. But Bobby Kennedy was somewhat different. He was more on top of everything and seemed to be more interested, particularly in the issue of race, than anybody around him. And I liked that. And and when he got ready, when Jack was killed, and went through all of that, and we all decided that there were several of us. Earl Graves, who had been my working partner in the bureau, he was a federal agent too. Earl founded Black Enterprise magazine and became one of the foremost black businessmen in America. Well, he was one of my closest friends. I participated in his wedding. We worked together. We were in the bureau together. And so Earl started out, I recommended that Earl work for Bobby Kennedy. And Earl served as an assistant to Senator Kennedy for several years, up until the time he was killed. And so when he got to be senator and everything, you know, we started moving up in several different ways.
Did you hear from Bobby Kennedy after the assassination? Or shortly after? Or?
Yeah, sometime after. He decided that, I heard from Steve Smith, his brother-in-law, and they were going to run Bobby for president later on. And so we had a meeting in the New York Hilton Hotel in the penthouse suite. They had just built a New York Hilton Hotel that time. And there were about 15 or 20 of us in this room trying to help Bobby decide whether or not he should run for president. Mm-hmm. And it came out that he would run and that we would all support him. And I came out of that as one of his supporters.
What were some of the questions? What were some of the pro and con in that debate?
Well, that his brother had been killed, and I think there were a number of members of his family who did not want him to run. But he was set on running.
Right.
And his brother-in-law, Steve Smith, was the one who was pushing it and raising the money and And so he decided that that's what he wanted to do. And so everybody in that room and others that we collected rallied around him to support him to run for president.
We will talk about some other incredible meetings and rooms in which Robert Brown has been an important participant as our conversation continues on the state of things. Robert Brown of High Point, North Carolina, my guest, the founder of BNC International in the Triad. Our conversation continues just ahead. First, we're going to hear some music from Be the Moon. You're listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here's Be the Moon. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio, and my guest today is Robert Brown, the founder and CEO of BNC International right here in High Point, North Carolina. And as a public relations consultant, he worked with Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, President Richard Nixon, Woolworths, AMP. Let's talk about that, this remarkable decision on your part to leave Washington, to leave what was a good job, and everybody told you what was ahead for you in your future, and you said, no, I'm coming back to North Carolina to be part of the solution. Formed a PR firm and had to essentially crawl into the belly of the beast. You were a consultant for Woolworths right down here at the corner, about a block away, and there was quite an episode here 52 years ago.
Yes, it was. I didn't realize all of what I was getting involved in at the time. I knew that there were a lot of problems, and I was following what I had perceived as my mission, and my mission was to help get into these difficulties and try to resolve them in different communities all over America, because America was suffering at the time. These problems existed in New York and Chicago and California. They existed everywhere.
Right.
More difficult in the South because it was more embedded here.
What did they want from you? Why did they hire you in A&P? What did they want from you?
They wanted, they had no concept of what to do about a problem that they were faced with, a race relations problem. They had never been involved with a problem like this before in the history of America. And so actually it wasn't just Woolworth and A&P, it was all the major corporations, whether they were in the South, North, East, or West. And so they really didn't know what to do. They didn't understand the black community. They had no idea of how it worked and who to contact to help resolve the problems, because although the problem existed for many years, nobody had ventured out to try to resolve the problem. And they wanted somebody. Well, I came up with different ideas. I went to them with ideas of how they could attack the problem and not just sit and wait and for somebody to come. I said, you got to go into the communities. You got to meet the people. I said, you go and with Woolworth, they had a big headquarters building, one of the biggest buildings in New York City. For a long time, it was the biggest and tallest building in New York City. And they didn't have one black secretary working in the place. And that's known a manager, an executive, anything. And so I told them that, hey, look, we need to do an inventory of this place. We need to integrate this place from top to bottom. We need to put blacks in different kind of positions, and we need to do that not only in the headquarters in New York, but we need to do that in Alabama and Mississippi and North Carolina and all over the country, which they had never done. No major American companies before that time had ever done anything like this before, because we had never been faced with this problem in America before on a massive scale the way we were. And so I went all out and I told them, I said, you have no choice. And if I'm gonna stay here and do what I need to do, you give me the leeway and I'll get it done. Well, they gave me the leeway because they didn't have too many options. The options were like none. And so they gave me the leeway, and I went out and I showed them what could be done by hiring managers in different Woolworth stores all over the country. They didn't have managers almost anywhere except a few assistant managers here and there in New York and Chicago or somewhere in the black community where they had stores in the black community. And no black secretaries or anything like that. No blacks in the headquarters except janitors and people like that. And so we sought to change that. We changed it totally. We did inventories and assessments of every area of the country, every region that they had, and where they were changing people, or people were retiring and all that. I said, hey, look, we got to move a black person or some minority in that job. And that's what we did.
One of your SEAL test was not one of your clients, right? But it you played an important part in brokering what was the most among the great breakthroughs of the civil rights era, and with that, and you worked with Dr. Martin Luther King on that. Tell us about SEAL test.
Yeah, well, I was a member of Dr. King's board. He was one of my closest friends. I traveled with him all over the place. I went to jail, but I didn't go to jail with him. I went to jail probably a couple of times, but I went to jail once in High Point. They put me in jail for demonstrating at a segregated store or something. And but anyway, Dr. King called me one day. I served on his board, his executive committee, and everything, traveled with him. He called me one day from Cleveland. He said, Bob, we have a terrible problem in Cleveland. He said, we are trying to get some blacks in jobs at SEAL Test. They have a large operation in Cleveland. And he said, they won't even talk to us. He said, they won't even talk to us at all. They won't even have a conversation about it. And he said, if you can do anything, I would be very grateful. And I said, Martin, I'll try to do something. And I said, I know the people at A&P, they're one of my clients, and I know that they buy a lot of SEAL Test products. And I'll fly to New York and see if there's anything I can do. So I flew to New York, went into the office of the chairman of the board. And he said, well, Bob, what can I do for you? I said, well, you know, we got a problem. I said, we have a potential problem. And the problem was that if Dr. King and those were going to have a massive demonstrations in Ohio against SEAL Test, the only way they could do that is have SEAL Test products taken out of the grocery stores. And A&P at the time was the largest grocery chain in the world. And I represented them. And so I just told the chairman of the board, I said, hey, look, you need to have some of our guys to call seal tests and see what they're going to do about this problem, because we're not going to take this land now. He said, Bob, I think you're right. He calls one of the guys in, and he goes and calls seal tests and tells him what the chairman told him. Now, I told the chairman, I said, he asked me what we should do. I said, we ought to take all of the seal test products out of all the stores in Cleveland if they don't cooperate. And he, when the guy came in, he told his executive, he said, I want you to take, if they don't cooperate, I want you to take all of the seal test products out of all the stores in Ohio, not Cleveland, like I told him. And he called seal test, and seal test broke down immediately. They said, hey, we give, we had a prayer. They want to do anything. So immediately they start calling Dr. King. Now, Dr. King can't get in one word with them. So immediately they start calling him, and all of a sudden the breakthrough is massive all over the country.
And Dr. Martin Luther King was grateful. That's the backstory. Here's what you might have heard on TV that night.
The next day, Mr. A&P was calling on us. And Bob Brown, who is here on our board, and who is a public relations man representing a number of firms, came in. They called him in because he works for A&P also, and they didn't know he worked for us too. Bob Brown sat down with A&P, and they said, now, Mr. Brown, what would you advise us to do? He said, I would advise you to take seal test products off of all of your counters. A&P agreed next day not only to take seal test products off of the counters in the ghetto, but off of the counters of every store, A&P store in Cleveland, and they said to seal test, if you don't reach an agreement with SCLC and Operation Breadbasket, we will take seal test products off of every A&P store in the state of Ohio the next day. The next day, the seal test people were talking nice. They were very humble. And I am proud to say that I went to Cleveland just last Tuesday, and I sat down with the seal test people and some 70 ministers from Cleveland, and we signed the agreement. And this effort resulted in a number of jobs which will bring almost $500,000 of new income to the Negro community a year.
There it is. He said to you, Bob, I don't know what you told him, but my phone is ringing off the hook. Look, the story was old. Everybody knew what the problem was. It was in all the papers. Dr. King has been talking about it. Everybody knew the problem was the lack of hiring. What did you tell him? I mean, you said, you know, sort of issued an ultimatum, but again, that should have been clear to those executives. What was it about you and your message that you think turned those executives?
Well, I think it all comes to self-interest, and every major company and small companies involved are stockholder-owned. I mean, most of them are stockholder-owned. These are public companies. A&P was a public company. Seal Test was a public company. And particularly with the big investors in Wall Street in New York, they don't want to hear anything about taking business away. Now, adding business is all right, but anything that's going to take business away, they're going to be totally against it. They didn't care. And some of them were not integrationists by no means. They weren't looking for integrate everything, anything else. All they wanted to do is make sure that everything was going okay with their money coming in very smoothly. And if anything was going to get in the middle of that, they were going to be against it. And so all of the big businessmen in America understood that. They understood that in spades. And so you had to get that message mm-hmm. out to them. And I think that's how we dealt with a lot of situations in Mississippi, in Alabama, in Georgia. I went to all of the southern states when there were demonstrations, people being killed and everything else. It was a terrible time in America. I don't think most people realize just how difficult it was and how bad things were in many communities around America. It was difficult here in North Carolina, but not like it was in Mississippi and Alabama and some parts of Georgia. I mean, where people were being executed, and I mean, there were many times when I thought maybe they were gonna get me because I was being followed and all kinds of stuff, you know, hollered at in different places. But I went on because I just did what my grandmother used to tell me to do. She said, you know, I dare you to trust God and see what happens to you, son. She said, you just take God with you everywhere and he will open any door. You can climb any mountain. You can do anything. And I believed her from a little boy. She told me that. And I believed her, and I wanted to make my grandmother, I wanted to please her. I wanted her to be happy about what I was doing. And it lifted me up. Mm. It charged me up in every instance.
Well, you talked about the difficult times, and certainly Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of 1968. And about that time, you reconnected with Robert Kennedy, and again, were in a room full of people. Tell us about that.
Well, Dr. King, day that he was killed, we were supposed to have a meeting together in Atlanta, and he called the office where I was waiting for him and said that he wasn't going to be able to come back. He had to make another speech that night in Memphis. You recall a garbage worker strike is what he's working on. And I told his secretary, Dora McDonald, that I would fly back to North Carolina, and when she called me next the following week, I'd come fly back in and talk to him. So went to the airport, jumped on a plane, came back to North Carolina, landed in Charlotte. When I got off the plane, people were running like crazy around in the airport. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on. There must be some kind of emergency that I don't know about. So nobody would stop and say anything. I tried to stop people and nobody would. So I saw a sky cap and he was running too, with his little wheel thing in front of him. And I said, man, what on earth is going on? He said, man, where in the world are you being? Don't you know that Dr. King, they just killed Dr. King down there in Memphis? I couldn't believe it. That's how I found out. And then I called my house and talked to my wife, and she said that Atlanta had been calling me, people had been calling me, there were people at my house waiting for me because the young people wanted to burn up something, and they were doing that all over the country. And everybody wanted to talk to me. I said, well, I'm on my way home. I rented a car. And that was one of the longest drives of my life, drive from between Charlotte and High Point. I will never forget it because the radio was blasting about the violence that was taking place. And Martin Luther King Jr. was not a violent man. I mean, he preached and lived nonviolence. And when some of us thought that he ought to be a little bit more robust, he was preaching, he was trying to tone us down and say, hey, look, you can't fight. You got to leave it to God and he will take us through. And that was it. The next day, his secretary called me and said Mrs. King wanted me to come back to Atlanta and fly with her to pick up Martin's body. So that was a tough time. Mm.
You also, several months later, Senator Kennedy was assassinated. Yes. And so tell us about that night.
Well, the night before Martin's funeral, I had rented the presidential suite in the then brand new Hyatt Regency Hotel in Atlanta. And Earl Gray's, who was working for Bobby Kennedy, wanted to get a group of people, said the senator wanted to get a group of people together and just talk to some people about where we're going in the country. And they couldn't find any. There was no suite. Everything was taken. And he said, can we use your suite? I said, absolutely. But so we got people like Sidney Poitier, Bobby Kennedy, and other senators and people from all over, Sammy Davis Jr., and others from all over the country, politicians, entertainers, business people. And we chopped up the world and America for hours until about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we decided we'd better go to bed so we'd get up and go to the funeral the next morning. And but that was a time that that Bobby had said he was going straight ahead with a campaign to run for president. And almost everybody in the room decided to support him, including myself.
You did fundraising for Bobby Kennedy, right?
I did. I raised money, and I went to different people and talked about him and got endorsements from different people. And a few months later, he's killed. I was supposed to have been with him in California, but I sent one of the people who was working for me at the time, Reverend W. E. Banks, who had a First Baptist church in Thomasville, and I sent him to California. And I was in New York at a business meeting. About 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I get a call from Banks, and he tells me I'm in bed sleeping. And he tells me, he said, man, turn your TV on. He said, something bad has happened. He said, turn. I said, what? He said, he wouldn't tell me. He said, just turn. I turned my TV on, and it was on every channel. Bobby Kennedy has just been shot. And I could not believe it. I said, here we go again. A few months later, after Martin's killed, and then Bobby Kennedy's killed. And then I just wanted to get out of politics. I wanted to get away from business. I wanted to get away from everything.
But you didn't. And our conversation will continue, and we'll find out how you came to work for Richard Nixon when my conversation with Robert Brown, the founder and CEO of B&C International, continues on the state of things. First, a little music from Be the Moon, and we will be right back. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're live from Greensboro, and my guest today is Robert Brown, founder and CEO of B&C International. You talked about the fact that two of your close friends and associates, people you had worked with and for, Dr. Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, are killed. You're about to throw in the towel. And very quickly, you hear from a staff member from the Republican presidential candidate, Richard Nixon. Tell us about that conversation.
Well, I was in New York a few weeks after the senator, we buried the senator, and I ran into Clarence Towns and Ted Brown. Clarence was assistant to Ray Bliss, who was chairman of the Republican National Committee from Ohio, and they said they had been trying to call me. Well, I wasn't taking any calls during that time because I just didn't want to be bothered with any more politics or anything else. So, and he said, look, we need your help. I said, you know, I've never worked with the Republicans before. And he said, well, we don't want you to change your registration. We just want your brain and your contacts, you know. We don't want you to change your registration. We don't care if you're a Democrat or independent. We don't care what you are. And so I agreed to go to lunch with him. And that changed everything, because when I went to lunch, we had about a three-hour lunch or more, and we had some great food and a few drinks, and I agreed to work with them 2 days a week to give them advice and counsel. They wanted advice and counsel on different areas of the country and all that. So I agreed to do that. And one thing led to another. The first week, it was, instead of 2 days, it was 5 days. And then the next few weeks, it became a 7-day-a-week kind of situation. And they gave me all of the assignments that were just crucial, life and death kind of assignments.
Like what?
The one that they gave me that really changed my life was when they needed President, well, Mr. Nixon at the time, wanted to go into Rochester, New York, where Vice President Humphrey had gone. And they wouldn't even let him in the town. The demonstrators laid down in the streets and blocked all the streets off. And so he turned around and got back on his plane and left. Couldn't make his speech, couldn't go to the fundraiser, couldn't do anything. So Mr. Nixon was to go there in the next 5 days or something like that. And under no circumstances, he had told his campaign, top campaign people, Bob Finch and the rest of them, John Ehrlichman and all of them, that he wanted to go in. He didn't care what it took. He had to go in. He couldn't let the demonstrators stop him. And so they called me and they said, Bob, we need you to go to Rochester and see if you can unstop that thing up there. And so I flew to Rochester and I did an assessment, which I usually do, some people who work with me usually do, and looked around to see I tried to find out who was running everything, all these demonstrations. And I found two guys, they were two brothers, and they were the baddest dudes in Rochester. And so I spent a lot of time with them, told them what I was about and my relationships and all of that with Martin Luther King Jr. and that if we won this election, that I would personally reach back out to them and try to help transform all those different problems that they were demonstrating about in Rochester. And somehow or another, over the next 2 or 3 days, I convinced them that I was really truthful. And they checked my record back with some the civil rights people, and they told them I was okay. And so they decided to trust my wisdom about this. And so when Mr. Nixon came in, they not only didn't stop his plane, there were demonstrators, but we had them all on the side of the road. Nobody stopped Mr. Nixon's motorcade. He went right into the hotel, made a big speech. It was very successful. They had a fundraiser, and he was jubilant. And when he was on his way back to the airport, he told one of his top aides that he wanted to know who it was who worked this thing out, because he felt that this was crucial for his campaign. And so they didn't know. And so, but Bob Finch knew, but he was at the airport in the hotel. And so they called me, and Bob Finch called me, and he says, we want you to come to the hotel immediately at the airport and meet with me and Ehrlichman and Haldeman and all of them. And so I got in my car, raced to the airport, and I was trying to figure out what they wanted. So I walked into the room, and they said, come on in, Bob, get a drink, get some food, and so forth. they said, I know you're wondering about what we wanted. And I said, yeah, I was wondering. And they said, well, Mr. Nixon wanted to know who handled all of this for him in Rochester. And we told him you did. And so now he wants you to be on his plane as of early next week, the beginning of the week. He wants you to be on his plane with him and travel with him the rest of the campaign. Mm-hmm. Wherever he goes, you with him. Mm-hmm. So there won't be any way you'll get back to North Carolina for anything. So I came back home. I immediately came back home, got everything I needed, told my wife what was happening, and she didn't quite understand that. but I went back, and I met him in Cincinnati. I was to meet him in Cincinnati, where that was the last cross-country train trip of any presidential candidate during that year. Wow. That was in 1968. And I got on the train with Mr. Nixon and all the top aides and all of the campaign people and all of the news reporters like Dan Rather and just all of them, all of the Walter Cronkite and the fellow who wrote to Making the President, right, and all those right. guys. And I got to know all of them. So I traveled with him. I traveled to Mr. Nixon from then on until the end of the campaign. We ended the campaign when he voted in California. And then we rode back to the Waldorf Astoria later that evening and spent the night watching returns in
landslide, landslide victory. Richard Nixon wins, defeats Hubert Humphrey in one of the biggest landslides in American history. With 21% of the African-American vote, no president, I think before, but certainly no president since, no Republican That's since, right. has ever won that percentage of the African-American vote.
But I think the miracle of it was, not only did we get because we concentrated on doing some significant things in the African-American community. We got 21% of the African-American vote. In 1972, four years later, we did enough significant things across the country in the African-American community for black colleges, for businesses, and all kinds across the board, where we got 20% of the black vote in 1972. Mm. And the Republican Party hasn't gotten 20% of the black vote since 1972.
What did African-American voters get in return? You were working with Nixon. You remained on his staff, and you talked about some of the advances. Talk about Nixon's position on race. Where was he? Why? And you did make some enormous progress within that administration. What was happening?
Well, I hate to say I, but I was there, and I was right in the middle of it, and the president trusted me, and he gave me carte blanche. I attended all the cabinet meetings. I was one of about five or six people within the administration, and in addition to the cabinet, who attended all the cabinet meetings. Any pictures that you see in the history books, anything else, you'll see my picture there. But what was happening is that there were a lot of things wrong. And I knew about it because I'd worked with Dr. King and others, and I'd worked with all these companies, and I knew some of the wrongs that were taking place. And we set out to cure many of those wrongs. The black colleges, for instance, you know, here in Greensboro, we got A&T, we got all these other kind of Bennett and the rest of them. We got more black colleges in North Carolina than any other state in the union. And yet, we were getting very little of the money. I mean, the money was being chopped up all over the place, and we were getting none of it almost. And that, so there was suffering going on all over the place. So I figured out ways to do it, to get money to the black colleges, to black businesses, create more black businesses. We created the Office of Minority Business Enterprise, which is still there, but just barely, because Mr. Obama eliminated all of the district offices that we set up all those years ago since he's been in prison. We had the race relations thing in the military. When we took over in the Nixon years, there were three black flag officers. And when I left administration in 1973, there were enough of them that I didn't even know all of them. I mean, you know, they were all over the place. And that only occurred because we decided that that when the papers would come over to the White House from the Pentagon for the generals to get their promotion, that all those papers would come to my office, and that if there wasn't a black or a woman on the list, then it went back to the Pentagon. So we did that for about 5 months, maybe 6 months, and all of a sudden, something must have clicked over there at the Pentagon, because they got the message, and every time we'd see a paper come into the White House, it had blacks and women on it. And so as a result, 10 years later, you look up and you got blacks and generals all over the place, Colin Powell, all the rest of them. All these people, that was no accident, because it had been one way forever, and it was going to be one way. But you have to figure out ways and means to do it that are fair, that everybody, the white, black, blue, and green can take part. Because when you go to lose your life in the military, it's not just, you know, a white life or a black life. It's a life, and all lives matter.
But you talked about the fact that your wife and others in your community, when you told them what you were about to do, were a little skeptical about you working for a Republican, and Richard Nixon in particular. People might be surprised today to hear about all of the advances that happened in the Nixon administration. Why? What do you think? Why do you think he made that choice?
Well, when he decided to hire me, and I didn't ask for the job. I mean, in fact, I told him early on that I did not want to come to work in the administration, that I wanted to stay in my business, but I'd be a consultant. I'd work with him, give him advice and counsel. I'd do everything. But he decided against that. And so early on, I adhered to his wishes and told him that I'd come and stay for a year. I stayed 4 years and 3 months, you know. So it's sometimes when you get a job like that, you can't get away. I mean, you get roped in, and that's what happened to me. But there were many things going on. He relegated a lot of that, I'd say everything that having to do with race relations and integration of schools. Like in 1971, the schools were supposed to be integrated from 1954 when the Supreme Court decision was issued. 1971, the schools are still segregated in the South. 1971, and we had been in office, and the president was getting a lot of criticism that almost like he's responsible for segregation of schools in the South. And so we formed a committee within the White House. And I was to take over the principal part of contacting key people in the South and trying to get that worked out. Well, we got it worked out, because what we did is we set up a committee in every Southern state. And I went to every Southern state and talked to all these different people. And then after I talked to these top people in these Southern states, including North Carolina, we brought them up to the White House. We brought them up to the White House. And then we would tell them exactly what we wanted to do. And on top of that, we would have the president come in and talk to him and tell him, hey, here are the rules of the game. We're not going to tolerate any violence. The schools are going to be integrated, and we're going straight ahead with the country. The country can't handle that. And as a result, when the school year started in 1971, all across the South, all the schools were integrated. And not one incident occurred, not one killing, not one person was arrested, anything on the day the schools were integrated.
Let me ask you, Robert Brown, a remarkable story. And once again, we're out of time. I have 1 minute left to ask you the big question. Where are we today? It feels like we're backsliding.
I think to some extent we are backsliding. I don't see the kind of togetherness that we were pushing and that we had at many points in our nation across the board, north, south, east, and west. I think we need to be more together. We are one people. I mean, when ISIS comes over here and bomb, they don't pick white people or Jewish people or black people or other people, Indian people. They bomb people because you're an American. They bombing. They killing you because you're an American. And so we need to understand that we are all in this pot together, no matter how we feel or what our situation is. Let's be together. Let's move this country ahead. There's so many things that we need to do. Even now, we need to be together. We need to be pushing our public officials and telling them that, hey, look, we need improvements in our schools and in our communities across the board. We need more companies, not sending all our companies offshore to create jobs everywhere else. We need them here. So we need to go forward in that direction, I think.
Robert Brown, what a pleasure. Robert Brown, CEO and founder of BNC International, one of the nation's oldest minority-owned businesses. Thank you for being on the show, and thank you to Be the Moon, who's going to play us out today. Be the Moon, a local band here in the Triad. Be the Moon.
Johnny came home back in 53 with a little purple ribbon and a blown out knee. Bought a little house in the middle of the street. Took Sarah for his wife and he settled down to be. Johnny went wild and Sarah went crazy. Said the words dried up and she thought was lazy. Me sitting here with a newborn baby. This will have to see. They want me to believe in a golden age. In a time before we fell away. Sarah bore a son who was white like his father. He could have stopped and looked up, but he didn't even bother. Sarah worked counseling, it was all she could offer. Sarah buried Johnny late last year. Nobody came to her, nobody shed a tear. Her son's doing time in the Knoxville pen for the second degree that gave her life plus 10. They want me to believe in a golden age. In a time before we fell away. They Thank you.